I live on the coast of Southern California in maybe one of the most beautiful places on the planet, Ventura County. The weather is temperate all year round with an average of 70 degrees Fahrenheit, right around 21 degrees centigrade. The beaches are pristine and almost always uncrowded. The county has several prime surf spots. But every so often, usually during the winter, storms throw up huge waves that trash the shore. Some of these storms are local, wash down huge piles of debris from the hills that then wash up on the beach. Others are far to the south of us, off the coast of Mexico, but they roll up waves that travel north and erode the sand, altering the shoreline. Well, in the 5th and 6th centuries, waves of barbarian invasion from the north and the east swept across Europe to alter the political and cultural landscape and prime Europe for the Middle Ages. This episode is a follow-up to episode 32. We're going to go into a little more detail on the various Germanic tribes that moved in on the remains of the Western Roman Empire in the 5th and 6th centuries. Now, I know that this isn't super exciting, hearing about all these tribes and where they went. And it hits only tangentially on church history, which, of course, is what this series is about. But we can't really understand the church in Europe and what takes place there without realizing the mass movements of people that took place at this time. So hang with me as we engage in a little historical stage setting. European history of the 5th and 6th centuries was dominated by the movement of mostly Germanic peoples into the territory of the old Roman Empire. The subsequent displacement of populations had a major impact on Christianity in the West. Medieval civilization was a result of this barbarian upheaval, coupled with the vestiges of late Roman society and the impact that Augustine had on the theology and practice of the church. The incursion of Germanic tribes into the Roman Empire was just the first of four massive waves of migration. The Germans came in the 5th century. The Vars and Slavs swept into the Balkans in the 6th. The Muslims in the 7th. And the Vikings in the 8th to 10th centuries. The resulting societal changes created by these invasive migrations had a monumental effect on the church. We're going to take a look now at just the first of these population shifts, the Germanic invasions. The 5th century saw the climax of what was really a long process of mostly controlled immigration by the Germans. They settled land at the empire's frontier and served in the military. While the Romans referred to the Germans as barbarians, it was they who often preserved the empire by filling gaps in the declining population of Roman lands and by manning the legions. It was the perfect storm that saw things go figuratively south for Rome. Factors combining to generate this perfect storm were, number one, the Germans were pressed by invaders out of Central Asia. Number two, key treaties between the Romans and the Germans were broken. And third, the warm weather that had seen a population boom in northern Europe was followed by bitter cold, so that the Germans were forced south in search of lands to sustain their now larger numbers. It didn't help Rome that the Germans now knew Roman military tactics and bore Roman arms. Note to self, if you don't want your neighbor to take over your house, don't give him the keys. Now, certain dates in the first half of the 5th century are important. The first contact that the Romans had with the Western Goths, also known as the Visigoths, came during the reign of the Emperor Decius. During Constantine's reign, they became allies and often entered the legions at elevated ranks. The Visigoths were being pressured from the east by the Huns, and in 376 sought refuge on the Roman side of the Danube River. The Emperor Valens granted their request, and there began a mass conversion of the Goths to Arianism. When mistreated by Roman governors, they revolted in 378 and killed the Emperor Valens at the Battle of Adrianople, and thus began the real Germanic invasion of the empire. In 410, the Visigoths sacked the city of Rome. By 419, the Visigoths had subdued southern Gaul and all of Spain. In 451, Attila and the Huns from Central Asia swept through Western Europe, and then they were defeated by an alliance of Romans and Germans led by Aetius. But in 455, Aetius and Emperor Valentinian III were assassinated, and the Vandals, under their leader Gaiseric, sacked Rome. We'll come back to that later. As we noted in episode 32, when Germans invaded the Western Empire in the 5th century, for the most part, they came not as pillaging pagans, but as Arian Christians. A Goth bishop named Theophilus had attended the Council of Nicaea in 325. The missionary who'd taken the gospel to the Goths was a man by the name of Ulfius in the mid to the late 4th century. Now, Ulfius had amazing success in seeing the Germans won to faith for two reasons. Number one, their native religion was in decline. Simply put, their god seemed rather old and shabby. And number two, the many German tribes shared a common language. Realizing that translating the Bible into German was a key to successful evangelism, Ulfius spent considerable time on the project before his death. He left the books of Samuel and Kings out of his translation because he figured the Goths were already warlike enough. In 406, when Rome recalled the legions from the Rhine to protect Italy, another Germanic tribe called the Vandals poured into Gaul, then southwest into Spain, and eventually jumped the Strait of Gibraltar to harass North Africa. Their king, Gaiseric, led them to Carthage, which he conquered in 439 and made the capital of an Arian Vandal kingdom. Gaiseric was intolerant of any other form of the faith. Now, at first, the Donatists in North Africa rejoiced at the coming of the Vandals. Remember that they had been labeled as heretics by Rome. But it didn't take long for them to realize that the enemy of my enemy isn't always my friend. The Vandals were not friendly. So in 484, a Donatist Catholic synod met to try to patch up their theological differences. Catholics were persecuted under some of the Vandal kings in the late 5th and early 6th centuries. It was this persecution that gave the Vandals a bad name far more than any actual acts of vandalism. Really, the Vandals were no more barbaric than any of the other Germans. Justinian's famous general Belisarius repulsed the Vandals and reoccupied North Africa for the Byzantine Empire in 534. Now, the Visigoths and the Vandals were followed up by the Suevians, the Burgundians, and the Franks. The Franks were the least mobile of the Germanic tribes. They settled in North France and expanded their rule from there. They joined several other German tribes along with the Romans to stave off the common threat of the Huns in 451. Of all the German tribes, the Franks were the least inclined to heed the work of Christian missions. They seemed immune to conversion until their king Clovis in the mid-5th century. Now, Clovis's conversion to the faith was a significant moment in the history of Europe. Since the Vandals, Goths, and Burgundians had been Arian, it seemed likely that Arianism would take over the West. Alone of the Germanic kingdoms, the Franks, under Clovis, embraced the Catholic Nicene form of Christianity, the major faith of his European subjects. In 492, Bishop Avitus of Vienna arranged the marriage of a Burgundian princess named Clotilda to Clovis. Clotilda was a committed Christian of the Nicene flavor. The royal couple had a son who was baptized but died while he was still in his baptismal robes. Clovis, who at that point was still a pagan, loudly declared his gods would not allow such a thing to happen. Oh, later, they had another son, and that one thrived. But then, in battle with the Alemanni and things not going in his favor, the desperate Clovis asked for the aid of the Christian God, and the battle turned in his favor. So, when the Alemanni were defeated, in appreciation for divine assistance, Clovis submitted to Christian baptism. Bishop Remigius of Reims performed the rite on Christmas Day of 496. Now, the source for all of this is a work by Gregory of Tours titled History of the Franks. And this book gave the Franks their identity, shaped their understanding of the future that they were to have in forging European history. Following his baptism, Clovis was anointed in his role as monarch. This anointing of the king by a bishop became a custom among the Franks. The resulting aura of sacred Christian kingship seemed to justify Frankish control of the church. Sadly, Clovis's character remained little changed by his official acceptance of Christianity. He'd adopted the religion, well, really as a matter of political expediency. He wasn't an actual convert to the faith. In 493, Odoacer, the German general who'd forced the abdication of the last Western Roman emperor a little less than 20 years before, he was killed by the Eastern or the Ostrogothic king Theodoric. Now, next to Clovis, Theodoric was the most important ruler of the barbarian kingdoms. Theodoric made Ravenna in Italy his capital. He was an Arian who adopted Byzantine culture. Though he was personally tolerant, his Nicene Catholic subjects weren't so much. His rule saw the last flowering of the Roman culture in the West. The Ostrogothic kingdom continued until 553, when the Eastern general Belisarius retook much of Italy for the Byzantine Empire. The cultural revival that occurred during the first half of the 6th century has been called the Indian summer of Christian antiquity. This period saw a number of influential persons who laid the foundation for early medieval society. Boethius was from a leading Roman family who became a philosopher and statesman in the court of Theodoric. Although loyal, Boethius came under suspicion, and Theodoric had him imprisoned and then executed. While in prison, Boethius wrote his most famous work, called The Consolation of Philosophy. Now, this work is important because it marks the transition from the church fathers, or what's called the patristics, to the scholastics, who we'll talk about more later. Through his translations, Boethius handed to the Middle Ages the ethics and the logics of Aristotle. The scholastics regarded Boethius as the greatest authority in philosophy after Aristotle. Dionysius Exiguus was a Central Asian who came to Rome toward the end of the 5th century. He collected and translated the canons of the Eastern Church from Greek into Latin. He also collected the canons and papal decrees of the Western Church. His work bore tremendous ecclesiastical authority. But Dionysius had a much wider significance in that he introduced a system of dating based on the Christian era, beginning with the incarnation of Christ. He's the one who came up with the whole BC and AD markers to divide time. Until that time, the secular method for charting the date was determined by the rule of the consuls of Rome and the empire of Diocletian. Unfortunately, Dionysius miscalculated the date of Jesus' birth so that, according to contemporary reckoning, Jesus was born in 4 BC. This also was the time of the Pope Gregory the Great, who we'll soon devote an episode to. Last in the chronicle that we'll include in this list of barbarian invasions is the Lombards. In 568, this Germanic tribe broke through the northern bounds of Justinian's empire and entered Italy. Gregory the Great turned them back in 593 and secured peace by dividing Italy between Lombard and imperial lands. The Lombards, they were a factious lot and ruled from three centers. The kingdom of Pavia in the north threatened the imperial capital at Ravenna. The duchies of Spoleto and Benevento in central Italy were a danger to Rome and Naples. The Lombards were Arian in their faith. Their acceptance of Catholic Christianity didn't come until the 7th century. As we move to wrap up this episode, let's take a look at the effect of these barbarian invasions. It turns out that Augustine wasn't the only one who attempted a literary response to the Germanic invasions. With the sack of Rome in 410, it seemed that the end of the ages had come. Orosius wrote 7 volumes against the pagans to show that the pre-Christian world suffered no less than the present. The work became a kind of manual for understanding history in the Middle Ages. Orosius gave a central place to the Roman Empire in God's plan. His history placed on the Western mind the idea of the divine role of Roman civilization. Now, Jerome had already interpreted the fourth kingdom of the Book of Daniel as Rome and concluded that it was to continue as long as the church did. Orosius promoted that view that both the Hebrews and the Romans had played an important part in the salvation of the world. Salvian's work, which was titled On the Divine Government in 440, promoted the historical significance of the Germans. He exaggerated their good characteristics as set over against Roman corruption, and he said that God had used the Germans as the sword of his judgment on a wicked Rome. 3 attitudes prevailed in Europe regarding the barbarian invasions. Augustine held that ultimately political success or failure makes no difference. His focus was on the world to come. In contrast, Orosius said that Christianity was the guarantor of the empire's prosperity. Salvian claimed that the empire was punished for its sins. But an interesting thing happened once the German invaders settled down in the old Roman lands. By and large, they shed their Arian-flavored faith for the Nicene Catholic Christianity, and they adopted the Roman culture, or at least what was left of it. Over a couple of generations, they came to identify themselves as Romans rather than Goths or Franks, Burgundians, and Lombards. But even with these adaptations to Roman culture, the old Roman and the new Germanic peoples were divided by language. Romans spoke Latin, Germans Goth. Customs of food and dress carried on in many places, with the Latins wearing their togas while the Germans wore their trousers. Their legal systems differed, and laws were applied to the different classes in the same kingdom. It took centuries for the two peoples to blend and become the nations of modern Europe. Greco-Roman civilization was based on cities. the Germanic invasions brought a decline to those cities. A rural economy developed in the West, accelerating the move to what we've come to associate so centrally with the Middle Ages, feudalism. While in the East, cities remained the main fixture of social organization, in the West, it was landed estates that rose to prominence. Rulers relied on their own lands, and so there was a decentralization of the government. With a decline in centralized government in the West, the church took over many of the services once provided by the state. Churches and monasteries were bound to the agricultural economy of the West and profited by a close relationship with local rulers, the nobility. But one thing that saw the importance and influence of the church grow substantially at this time was the fracturing that occurred in the political realm. When Western Europe was divided up into hundreds of smaller regions, each with its own ruler, the universal authority of the church under Rome and the regional bishops provided, well, a continuity that was desperately needed. No secular authority in the West was able to control the church as an organ of state to the same extent as in the Eastern Empire. And so in the West, rather than kings ruling the church, it was bishops who increasingly played a role in political affairs. And there was one bishop who emerged to dominate them all, the Bishop of Rome. We need to back up now and do some work in charting the progression of the role of the Bishop of Rome, who came to be known as the Pope. Several of the factors that elevated the church at Rome to prominence by AD 200, well, they were still in play by the 4th and 5th centuries. By the dawn of the 3rd century, the church at Rome was already claiming an overriding apostolic authority over the faith derived from Peter and Paul. By the 5th century, Paul's name had pretty much dropped out. His historical role in the church at Rome was forgotten in favor of the, well, textual argument based on three key New Testament passages that seemed to assign Peter a special place as the de facto leader of the church under Christ. And for those of you taking notes, those passages are Matthew 16, Luke 22, and John 21. Now, as noted in previous episodes, another factor lending weight to Rome's claim as the theologically premier church was the theological steadfastness of the bishops of Rome during the Arian controversy. Rome simply maintained a reputation for orthodoxy and often articulating that faith in a clear and cogent manner that pulled the rug out from under the Arians. It's interesting that the bishops of Rome never attended even one of the ecumenical councils. And by doing so, they tended to avoid the sometimes nasty political maneuverings that accompanied the councils. While Alexandria and Antioch duked it out in bragging rights over whose bishop was invited to lead the church at Constantinople, the bishop at Rome ignored all. Because, well, we know, who's in charge? Arguing who's in Constantinople is like arguing who sits in the front passenger seat while the Pope is driving. Administratively, Rome adhered to the tradition of a local and provincial synods twice a year. This group of conservative bishops was the vehicle through which their leader, the bishop at Rome, acted. That stood in contrast to the synod at Constantinople, held, well, only when some need pressed and was really only attended by those bishops inclined to show up. And when they did, well, they often held varying loyalties between Alexandria, Antioch, and Constantinople. You remember the council at Ephesus in 431, where it became a bloody brawl. The Eastern councils even altered each other's creeds and conclusions. So with that kind of confusion in the East, it's a little wonder that Rome appeared, well, a bastion of stability. Geographically, by reason of his location, the Roman bishop had a voice that was heard far and wide. And keep in mind that Rome was the only patriarchate in the West, while the East had three. Politically, Rome, while still highly symbolic, was no longer the political center of the West. Milan, and then later Ravenna, were the capitals of the Western Empire. And with that royal absence, Rome's bishop became the city's most important figure. Likely for this reason alone, the associations of imperial Rome began to surround the church's government. The word pope derives from a word used by Greek children for their father, papas. It was first used in Latin at the beginning of the 3rd century as really an informal title for the Bishop of Carthage. From there, the bishops of Alexandria picked it up and began to be called Pope a few decades later. It's still the title of the Coptic Patriarch of Alexandria. The first known use of the word for the Bishop of Rome comes from an inscription in 303 for Marcellinus, But a lack of attribution going forward over the next decades means that the word was really not common until later in the 4th century. The title then became almost exclusively associated in the West with the Roman bishop from the 6th century on. In covering how the bishop at Rome became the pope, we need to look at how it was that other bishops came to regard him not just as a first among equals, but as someone ordained by God to be in authority over them, someone they owed obedience to as God's earthly representative. It's evident to anyone who takes the time to study the subject that while a growing number of bishops came to this conclusion, it was by no means something that everyone acknowledged. The issue even led to the great rift between the Eastern and Western churches. So let's track, in outline at least, how the bishop at Rome became pope. In the mid-4th century, during the tenure of the Roman bishop Julius, the third canon of the council at Sardica in 343 established the rule that a bishop who'd been deposed or removed from his post could appeal to the bishop of Rome. This was an important step in the recognition of his appellate authority. Also in the mid-4th century, the most important bishop of Rome for advancing the claims of his see was Damasus. He became bishop after a contested election in which there was bloodshed between his supporters and those of his rival. Damasus made regular references to Rome as the apostolic see and spoke of the primacy of the Roman see on the basis of Matthew 16, verse 18. Damasus sanctified the burial sites of previous Roman bishops in the catacombs, marking them with ornate inscriptions. He reformed the Latin liturgy and commissioned Jerome to revise the Latin Bible, resulting, of course, in the Vulgate. Now, instead of adopting the posture and accoutrements of a humble shepherd of God's flock, Damasus affected an imperial aura reminiscent of an emperor. So exalted was he that the pagan historian Ammianus Marcellinus hinted that he might become a Christian if he could be the bishop of Rome. At the end of the 4th century, the Roman bishop Siricius regarded even his letters as being authoritative edicts and styled them as being apostolic. Now, shortly after that, Innocent I declared that Sardica's third canon giving the Roman bishop appellate power was retroactive to the Council of Nicaea in 325. Innocent said that the church's highest teaching authority belonged to Rome. He extended his authority beyond the realm of the Western Empire into the province of Illyricum and started referring to the Roman bishop as vicar. Boniface I added to the power of Rome's bishop by prohibiting appeals beyond Rome. But it's Leo I, also known as Leo the Great, who can rightly be referred to as the first pope in that he embodied what that title means for most people today. He combined authority over councils and emperors with the idea that the Roman bishop was Peter's successor in constructing his theory of the papacy. One of Leo's sermons, delivered on the first anniversary of his election, explained the Petrine theory in terms of the Roman law of inheritance. Leo argued that Jesus gave Peter the keys of the kingdom and so authority over the other apostles. He also claimed, after long tradition, that Peter was the first bishop of Rome, and his authority was then passed on to subsequent bishops there at Rome. Therefore, Leo reasoned, the perpetual authority of Peter is found in the current Roman bishop. He dispensed with earlier views of church leadership and made the authority of bishops dependent on the pope. Important to note is that at this point, with Leo the Great as pope, that the bishop of Rome stood between Jesus Christ and other bishops. When Leo's tome was read at the Council of Chalcedon, the bishops echoed his claim with the acclamation that Peter spoke through Leo. Chalcedon was unusual in that it gave assent to Rome's teaching authority, something previously unknown and later seldom acknowledged in the East. While Rome's primacy was taken as a fact in the West, it was a different story in the East. The Council of Chalcedon ranked the eastern capital as next to Rome in terms of authority, but Rome never accepted that canon, concerned that by doing so it would degrade Rome's claim to absolute authority. In his tome, Leo drew a comparison between the two natures of Jesus and the two parts of the empire, that is, the religious and the civil. Specifically, he referred to the priesthood and the kingship. He compared Peter and Paul as founders of the Roman church to Romulus and Remus as founders of the Roman city. He presented the Pax Christianum as a counterpart to the Pax Romanum. Leo's policy toward the barbarian was to civilize and sanctify them. Romans referred to Leo as the consul of God, Leo negotiated with the Hun leader Attila to get them to turn back from sacking Rome. He even claimed the title of the pagan chief priest of Rome, the Pontifex Maximus, for himself, the chief bridge builder. He was the first Roman bishop to be buried in St. Peter's. It's clear that most of the powers and privileges of future popes were seen in Leo's methods and policies. He acted as a head of Rome's civil government, checked the advance of barbarians, enforced his authority on distant bishops, preached doctrine, and intervened in the Council of Chalcedon. While Augustine provided the intellectual substance for the medieval Western Church, really it was Leo that laid down its institutional form. At the end of the 5th century, Pope Gelasius took Leo's papal authority even further. He foresaw that the Emperor Marcian's claim to being a spiritual authority and kind of priest-king at the Council of Chalcedon was dangerous. Gelasius said that the Old Testament functions of prophet, priest, and king were filled by Jesus Christ alone as the God-man. Among mere humans, these functions were to be kept separate, and that in the kingdom of God, priests were superior in authority to kings. This position became a major point of tension throughout the Middle Ages. It will be the crucible that produces much of the history of Europe for the next few hundred years. Now, Pope Gelasius continued the claim that it was the office of the Roman Church to judge other churches, but could be judged by no human tribunal. By the end of the 5th century, the Western Church virtually equated the kingdom of Christ with the Church. In the East, the ideal of a Christianized empire continued on. The reign of the Eastern Emperor Justinian seemed an affirmation, even a confirmation of that. As we end this episode, I want to take a little time to clarify some words that anyone who studies church history is bound to encounter. It's some titles for church leaders. The problem is sorting out exactly what these words and these titles mean, who they refer to. I'm referring to the words pastor, priest, monk, bishop, archbishop, metropolitan, and patriarch. Now, what follows is by no means a technical definition for these things. This is meant more as a practical and vastly simplified working definition for those who want really a quick handle on what these things mean as they review church history. So understand right off that these are words been fluid in terms of definition over time. Pastor, that's a good New Testament word that's really synonymous with the words elder and bishop or overseer. All the words refer to the same office and ministry in the local church. And by the way, they do refer to that scope, a local church, not someone who oversees other pastor elder bishops. Elder refers to a man's maturity and character as morally and spiritually fit to lead a local church. Bishop, that refers to his office as a spiritual authority and overseer, while pastor refers to his task as a shepherd of God's flock. 100 or so years after the apostles, pastors were regularly called bishops because they oversaw a team of fellow elders and deacons who served God by serving his people. We ought to think of bishops as equivalent to senior or lead pastors in today's churches. Now, keeping to that analogy, imagine there aren't several different churches of different denominational stripes in your town. There's just one church, and that's led by a senior pastor called a bishop. That church then sends out several younger pastors to plant churches in surrounding communities. They're going to look to their sending church and its bishop as a kind of spiritual parent. And if they, in turn, send out even more pastors to plant more works, that original sending church and pastor takes on kind of a highly respected role of providing guidance, not just for his local congregation, but for all those works that they spun off. And so he becomes an archbishop, because those local pastors are called bishops. What happened over the first few hundred years of church history was that five churches became recognized as centers of church life and authority, one in the West, at Rome, of course, and four in the East, Alexandria, Antioch, Constantinople, and a fourth that tended to vary over time from Jerusalem to Caesarea and Carthage. The bishops of these five churches were at first affectionately referred to as patriarchs because they were regarded as spiritual fathers to their surrounding provinces. Over time, that title morphed from being merely an unofficial term to an outright title, capital P, patriarch. The term metropolitan was applied to the bishops of other large cities and their surrounding provinces beyond the five patriarchates. Metropolitan is essentially synonymous with archbishop. A priest, well, that was someone who was officially ordained by a bishop to serve communion and baptize converts. And that, of course, was just a very small part of his overall pastoral duties. Monks were people who devoted themselves to the service of God rather than secular employment. They may or may not be ordained as priests. And typically, monks lived alongside others in a cloistered community. The feminine form of the word monk is nonus, which turns into nun. Again, this is a highly simplified description of these roles, but I hope that it serves to help those of you doing your own reading in church history to sort out the various church offices.